This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Any Democrat is not just somebody who I might admire, but is going to essentially try to restore basic democratic principles and anti-corruption measures that really we should have. We should be in a Watergate moment.
What can all the money in the world buy you? Thanks to the Beatles, we already know it's not love. But could it perhaps buy you the most powerful office in the world? We may have the answer to this question as early as Super Tuesday, as one of the wealthiest humans on the planet attempts to buy the U.S. presidency. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to author Steve Almond about the state of the Democratic primary. He offers his perspective on what we should be learning from Mike Bloomberg's political ads that presently blanket our nation's airwaves, how the age of Trump changes the way that people view the field of presidential hopefuls, and what Democrats need to do if the nominee ends up being someone other than their favorite. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Steve Almond. He's an author and he teaches journalism at Harvard University. Steve, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you.
So we've had you on the show, I think, right before the election of Donald Trump in 2016, or right around that time. And since then, things have not gone great, I think we can agree on, in this country and
I mean, only if you believe in the sanctity of, you know, sort of human life and decency and, you know, equal opportunity and, you know, all that sort of, I mean, only if you're the kind of naive person who actually believes the founding documents.
Right.
If you're some other kind of American, things are going swimmingly.
Exactly. If you're worried about the bottom line for the NFL.
It's going great.
Things are peachy. You kind of encapsulated a lot of ideas politically that we had discussed in your last book, Bad Stories in America. But moving forward, let's look at the current state of the Democratic primary, because we're still 6 months away from D-Day and finding out whether or not we get four more years of Donald Trump. This is an environmental show. People who care about the environment have to say that probably the number one thing to help the environment is to get rid of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You just wrote a piece on WBUR.org, Boston Public Radio, about Mayor Bloomberg's entrance and his massive push onto the stage and the role of propaganda. You think that Democrats have something to learn from Bloomberg's success, don't you?
Yeah, and I should say from the kind of aggressive emotional appeal, when I say propaganda, I'm not suggesting that the Democrats should start trafficking in lies and conspiracy theories and overt fear-mongering. You know, that is the GOP playbook and has been for the last 50 years. The communists are coming, WMDs, you know, there's going to be a mushroom cloud, death panels, they're going to come for your guns and your religion, Sharia law. They have tried to turn the American story into a kind of horror movie where there's always some dark other hovering at the borders or in your community in sleeper cells. And it's an old play. It's meant to distract people from economic justice and other forms of justice, like environmental justice, by, you know, having some dark other that's going to take it all away from them. Fear of a brown planet is what I called it in Bad Stories. But nonetheless, what it demonstrates is fear is deeply motivating and it's primal. And poking at those primal negative emotions in the hands of a demagogue is a very effective way to get people to behave politically in ways that they want them to behave. And you're an environmental show, so you know that this is no joke. What we are seeing with weather events, with climate change itself, rise in sea levels, catastrophic storms, monsoons, what's happening in Australia, what's happening in Northern California, is the new normal. And all of that stuff, especially for people who are, you know, who are environmentally vulnerable areas, that is a real horror movie. That's not a fake made up, there are death panels that are going to kill your grandma. That is, we are all in a lot of trouble. And even if we make an about face and turn the battleship around and start to correct, start to actually go after fossil fuels and our dependence on them and hold ourselves accountable and stop sopping the corporations, even still, there's a lot to be frightened about. And I think the Democrats are in a moment where they need to use the motivating power of fear to make people realize this is bigger than Donald Trump and his bullying and his like psychodrama. This is a battle, not just for the soul of America, but literally for our environmental safety and that of our children and grandchildren. And there are very easy and obvious ways to do that. And I think the Democrats, they really put the gloves on and they need to be bare-knuckled about this. And that's one of the things that I think Blumberg has demonstrated. He's poured all this money in, but the reason his advertising is effective is because it hits people in the gut. I find it to be too much ad hominem, too much about Trump and his nonsense, but they're all sorts of issues in which the Democrats can make a convincing argument that we are unsafe as a country because of environmental ruin and what it is going to bring to us and communities, especially that are on the coast and that are vulnerable, because of gun violence and the proliferation of violent rhetoric, which leads to and the massive arming of civilian population that's led to this bloodshed. And right on down the line, there are a million different ways in which we are actually in danger. And it's not some phony made-up demagoguery meant to protect corporations and consolidate power and wealth. It's actually redounding to individuals like you and me who have to send kids to school where they literally in kindergarten have to be terrified by the prospect of what they're going to do if a bad man with a gun shows up at their school.
After the last Democratic debate with Mike Bloomberg in it, I spoke to my dad and he's undecided. And he was saying, well, Bloomberg didn't seem nearly as impressive as he did in his commercials. And I kind of laughed, but that tells me that those ads are working. If people who are just kind of on the fence are looking at him saying, oh, he seems pretty good. The power of advertising is not an antiquated concept. Even though people have 100 channels to watch, the madmen of the world are still earning their keep.
Well, not just that, but in fact, it's helpful that there are 100 channels, because that means if you want to really motivate people in Latinx communities, in all kinds of swing states, Arizona, wherever it is, in the places that are politically valuable, then do what the scumbag Republicans have been doing. They blast and micro-target an ad about basically outlawing abortion and restricting women's reproductive rights. Well, the Democrats should be blasting ads about what they are doing to refugees seeking asylum in this country and how they're ripping kids from their parents, and some of those kids are being sexually abused and or dying in U.S. custody, and that it should be terrifying. In any community where there are undocumented people or people whose immigration status is up in the air, that we now have a government that will weaponize our immigration system to go after the most vulnerable among us, that is the exact kind of micro-targeting that Democrats need to start using. How do you reach those people, whether it's on television or especially online? How do you reach them with a message, you are not safe under this administration. You are not safe. You or someone you know and somebody you know and love is in danger. And therefore, you have to take action and become part of the political system. If not by voting, then by activism, whatever you can do, fundraising, whatever it is that constitutes political action. And it's not just a matter of being brutal, as radical in seeking out the people who truly have to fear from this administration and making it clear to them why they have a stake in the political process.
As I read your piece, I kept thinking about Michelle Obama's famous quote about when they go low, we go high. And I think the brilliance of Barack Obama may have done a disservice to subsequent generations of Democrats, because I think what you're talking about really works with maybe less inspirational candidates than a Barack Obama. I don't think we have a Barack Obama in the race anymore. I don't think any of the remaining crew are giving anybody the chills. It's about policy and who can beat Donald Trump. And so I do agree with you that Democrats need to get in the mud, so to speak, in the general election.
Well, here's the way I would say it. I mean, I think there's a false dichotomy. And when Michelle Obama says, we go high, you know, they go low, what she means is we are appealing to the better angels of people's natures, to their rational thinking, to logic, to the old-fashioned standards of how you convince people of something. And I'm not going to argue with that. I think that's a beautiful ideal, just like all men were created equal, written by a slave owner, is a beautiful ideal. It's also a fraudulent story. The fact is, people act politically or become disengaged from the political process because it sounds like a bunch of noise that doesn't have anything to do with them. It's ugly people arguing on cable TV. It's a bunch of shyster politicians who are, you know, serving their own interests ultimately. And that's how people get detached and cynical about politics. What I'm suggesting is not that Democrats should get in the mud or should start, sort of launching ad hominems. I think they should make very clear to the populations that are literally in danger in particular ways. Everybody in Florida, especially concentrated on the coasts in southern Florida and the Gold Coast of Florida, should recognize that, that the changes in the environment are a direct threat to everything they hold dear. They should be micro-targeted with real ads about real things that are pose a danger to everything that is important to them, their communities, their homes, their property, their wealth, their kids' futures, all of it. Because that's not getting in the mud. That's actually trying to clear away the mud, the haze, the sort of smoke screen that corporations have put up around the environmental dangers that we are slowly marching our way into. You know, you know this better than anyone, Alex. Just because it feels a little bit warmer, but you're not boiled yet, doesn't mean that the frog isn't, that the burner isn't on. The burner is on. All I'm saying is somebody needs to point out in visceral ways that the burner is on. And it's not difficult to do. You know, there are models, easily reachable models, that show people what Florida is going to look like in 50 years. There are plenty of images that suggest the kind of environmental devastation we're already seeing. And there is scientific consensus about why those events are taking place. It's not anything that is, you don't have to create some false, scary narrative like the right. You just have to recognize and viscerally present the reality as it exists right now. That's not going low. That is trying to get people to recognize the stakes in a more forceful, visceral way. The only way in which it's going low is that it's appealing to people's gut instinct that we are in danger and trying to make, rather than have it be abstract and projected onto a bunch of phony opponents, to say, yes, we are actually in danger right now, and here's what's endangering us. My money and my money on my mind. Rolling nice straight, smoking in, oh, sipping on gin and juice, laid back.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Steve Almond. He is the author of over a dozen books and teaches journalism at Harvard. So, Steve, we're kind of fast-forwarding to the general election and what whoever is the nominee should do in terms of ad campaigns come the summer of 2020. But let's look just at where we are right now. Listening to Democrats bicker on stage, because it's really bickering a lot of times more than debating with six people up there, it's kind of hard to really have a true debate. The constant refrain I hear is that we have to be nice to fellow Democrats because we don't want to do the work for Donald Trump and the Republicans in the fall. Let's not criticize each other. But in the same moment, we're talking about how are we going to pay for Medicare for all, which is traditionally a Republican talking point. The centrists are saying, how can we pay for it? And then Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are up there saying, you know, it doesn't matter how we pay for it. We're going to have to pay for this one way or another. And it's the moral imperative of our time to be able to offer health care to everybody. This is a conundrum that any Democratic candidate faces right now. Is do you fight against Donald Trump right now? Or do you try to win the nomination by fighting against each other?
Yeah, I mean, that is precisely what they are up against. And my feeling, sort of big picture feeling, is individual voters like me. So I'm a person who supported Bernie in 2016, but then also realized, hey, Hillary Clinton's great, too. And I feel about all the candidates that they're seriously trying to solve problems And at the very minimum, and I think most of them are well over this threshold, trying to recognize and reckon with the abomination, the kind of walking corruption and sort of nihilistic anti-democratic path that the GOP is not just on, but like we're pretty far down it. Justice Department is no longer an independent agency. Now intelligence is going to be part of this kleptocracy, this kind of transnational crime syndicate that Trump has going. So any Democrat is not just somebody who I might admire, but is going to essentially try to restore basic democratic principles and anti-corruption measures that really we should have. We should be in a Watergate moment where we've recognized that the president is a corrupt person who abused his powers. And in the wake of Watergate, there was a national consensus about that. And so the president had to step down because even people in his own party recognized how manifestly corrupt he was. And all these great important measures were passed to get money out of politics and remove other kinds of pathways to corruption. And all of those, of course, the GOP gradually stripped away. And so eventually we get essentially a repeat of Watergate, another break into the DNC. And this time the media, rather than saying, Jesus, the Russians hacking our elections, that's a huge story, they start spreading this dirt. And this is essentially the media that we have now because we ourselves as human beings are oriented around conflict. We have a conflict bias. If people are fighting or landing punches, somehow like kids on a playground, we have to like look at who's punching who. And to me, that's part of what I was writing about in Bad Stories and how corrosive that set of attitudes are. But it's also something that the Democrats need to be able to individually and collectively exploit. And I think they're in a struggle because one of, you know, they're all ambitious people. One of them wants to be the nominee. And so their direct opponents right now, the people who are keeping them from that goal, are other people on stage. So it does turn Lord of the Flies. But to me, I sit there and go, look, it doesn't matter what I believe. I support Elizabeth Warren because I think she would be the best president. She has the best plan. She has the most integrity and decency based on her personal history. And, you know, I just think also, generally speaking, women are more empathic and more effective as leaders because they get less hung up on toxic masculinity, which is what we're swimming in and what Trump is the apotheosis of. But you know what, Alex? My feelings about Elizabeth Warren are much less important than my children's future. So I support her. I would love her to be the nominee, but I also recognize that's probably not going to happen. And whoever the nominee is, I'm not going to do what I did in 2016, which was kind of sit out of the process and say, well, whatever, you know, I'll write some articles, but I'm not going to actually give money, give my time and energy and activism. And I made that mistake in 2016. I did not make it in 2018. I worked very hard raising money, doing workshops, lots of other things to try to support candidates and causes I believed in. And I'm going to do that again. And I don't care who the nominee is. It could be somebody who's a quote-unquote centrist about whom I have misgivings and concerns that they're sort of Republican light, that they're sort of to the right of Nixon or whatever. I don't think I have the luxury of trying to find, you know, my candidate and saying if my candidate doesn't come through, the party's been sold out. I just think the stakes are too high. And so whoever it is, that process will play out. I'll play whatever role I can in it, but I'm saving most of my energy and my activism for the general election. And that's the moment, the months in which I will really do everything I can as a citizen so that I can just sleep at night. I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen other than the Republicans are already playing on a tilted playing field, and it's going to be ugly and dirty, and the GOP and Trump are going to try to make everybody as disgusted as possible so that they get cynical and they buy into that nihilism that shuts people down from political action. We all know that's going to happen. We need to protect our optimism. We need to be fanatically optimistic. And that's the approach I'm taking.
And that includes believing, no matter what information we're getting, to the opposite, that we have to believe in the process and our elections. And that's something that a lot of people, including myself, are very worried about, is the veracity of our actual elections. That, yeah. You know, that, and that's what I think was at the heart of this impeachment process, was this can all be in vain if the votes aren't counted correctly.
Trump is only president because of voter suppression, because of the Electoral College, because of the particular distortions in our political system in which votes do not count equally. I'm from Massachusetts. That's where I vote. You vote in California, I assume. There are people in Wyoming whose votes count, you know, four times as much as ours, and on down the line, voter suppression, a calculated campaign by the GOP to try to shrink the electorate. But it's bigger than that. The way you shrink the electorate is you make people tired of the noise. It's called censorship by noise. You have so many narratives, so many bad stories that are sort of brutally assaulting people that they get dispirited and they lose their optimism and they give in to the kind of nihilism and cynicism that ultimately benefits demagogues and ad men and people who want to sort of keep the status quo, the money and power consolidated, who believe it's okay and in fact it's inevitable that capitalism is a kind of centrifuge that concentrates wealth and power at the top. I just fundamentally feel like our battle is to remain optimistic and for individual citizens to say, you know what, I don't want to live in this country. It's too mean. It's too dark. We've got to change the leadership. And to say, and actually, I'm the subject of history. I'm not just the object of history. If I want that to happen, I need to stop expecting the millennials or the media or Susan Collins to grow a conscience. That's not going to happen. The GOP and Trump have told us who they are. Trump tells us who the GOP is. He's the logical endpoint of that kind of capitalist kleptocracy. You get somebody who's utterly and completely morally corrupt, who's going to bankrupt democracy like he's bankrupted everything else in his life. We now have a choice, and I think by a vast majority, most Americans are citizens of good faith. They just need to be reminded of why it matters and how they matter. And I think that's how you win. And to me, the candidates are not irrelevant, but they're much smaller than that larger sense of collective belief. I'm talking about faith, really.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Steve Almond. So, Steve, a little bit after Donald Trump was elected president, you wrote that public figures are no longer judged on experience or competence. And looking at a lot of the field in the Democratic primary, I can't help but think that the standard has gone down for Democrats, maybe because of Trump.
Yeah, but I think that getting lost in his bad story, his degradation of everything he touches, is part of his dark spell that he's cast over the body politic, or that we are helping him cast. And the truth of the matter is, there are all these good stories that are about the ways in which democracy can and does work. You know, a Parkland High School gets shot up, and the traumatized victims of that mass shooting, rather than buying the nonsense story by the gun lobby, says, we do not consent to your bad propaganda about it being an inevitability that we have to have such a weaponized civilian population. It's nonsense, it's crap, and it's all for profit, and we are going to tell a different story. You know, the teachers in red states like Oklahoma and West Virginia and Arizona, who believe that what they do is sacred and that they should have a livable wage, they march on the Capitol and become politically engaged, and they change laws and improve their circumstances in their own state, but they also in that process become politically motivated. The 2018 election, all of these new candidates who entered into politics and said, you know what, I refuse to be the object of history. I'm going to become the subject of history. Lauren Underwood and AOC and all of these brilliant people who happen to be women and women of color from vulnerable communities who are suddenly calling to account leaders of corporations and departments and literally questioning them under oath and saying to Mark Zuckerberg, so let me get this straight. It's okay to lie on your platform because it makes you money. Those are, that's your morality. You might be able to still be allowed to do that, but you are going to have to publicly say that you are that kind of morally bankrupt person. It's on the record now. You're going to have to go to sleep with that.
I do appreciate that optimism. And then there's the specter that's looming over the recent debate, which is if this billionaire, one of the world's richest men, should get the nomination, the autocracy versus democracy concept that you just put forth is turned on its head. That's really what's at stake with somebody like Mike Bloomberg entering the race very late, spending ridiculous amounts of his own money, and pretty much doing exactly what everybody feared when Citizens United got passed by the Supreme Court.
True enough, but Alex, here's the way I would think about that. And believe me, he sort of leapfrogged, you know, Elizabeth Warren. So I understand why it's so dispiriting. Here's the way I would try to look at it, the good story that I would put on that bad story. Okay, let's say Bloomberg, because of the system we live in, all that money, all that advertising, the political establishment says, oh, Bernie's too dangerous, he'll scare people in the suburbs, all that. Let's say Bloomberg's the nominee. The one thing I would say is, it is then our job to make sure that he is held to account for the values that the majority of the Democratic Party believes in now. And so somebody like Mike Bloomberg is going to have to recognize that he's going to have to change some of his attitudes and some of his policies. And you already see this in small ways. Believe me, I am no fan of the guy. I do not want him to be the nominee. But I also live in a world where I don't get to make that decision. I can play a role in it, but I'm not going to make that decision. So even the political pressure that's brought to bear on him around stop and frisk, around his policies towards Wall Street, on whatever it is, then that will be our task.
I agree, but you wrote about the founding fathers' ideals when they came up with this idea of democracy. And I think having one of the world's richest men against another, close to being a billionaire, autocrats facing off in the fall is very unsettling. Yes, Democrats will put Bloomberg to the fire when it comes to the Me Too movement, and he may have decent policies, but just the fact that this guy just bought his way into the top tier is really scary to me.
Listen, I couldn't agree more. And again, in an ideal world, you get money out of politics, but that's not the world we live in the moment. So we have to live within the possibility that a candidate like a Bloomberg is the nominee. Nobody gets the perfect candidate. And we all then have to sort of say, and this is what I was guilty of in 2016, I need to understand, and this is to bring us back to the what I was writing about with sort of running more visceral ads, we all need to, citizens of good faith need to understand what the stakes are for this election and that they are different and dramatically more important than in previous elections. Not just because of the fate of democracy, the fate of the planet is hanging in the balance. So there's suicide versus some kind of slow and difficult effort to reckon with the sort of trouble we're in. And that, to me, is the bigger rubric. I can get into individual candidates and this preference or that preference, but it's sort of like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. That's a bad analogy. The way to say it is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic and figuring out how to navigate it away from a fatal iceberg strike. That's what we have to do. And I might not think the captain's perfect, but if he can steer us away from that, well, then that we have to do everything we can when the time comes to support whoever that nominee is.
An optimistic voyage on the Titanic. We'll link to the WBUR piece that we're discussing on SeaChangeRadio.com. Steve Almond, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
All right. Thanks so much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Anjali Kijo, The Gourds, and Ike Riley. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.